Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
You're listening to the Pennsylvania Woodsman, powered by Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network.
This show is driven to provide relatable hunting and outdoor content in the Keystone State and surrounding Northeast.
On this show, you'll hear an array of perspectives from biologists and industry professionals
to average Joes with a lifetime of knowledge.
All centered around values aiming to be better outdoorsmen and women,
both in the field as well as home and daily life.
No clicks, no self-interest, just delight in the pursuit of creation.
And now, your host,
the pride of Pennsylvania,
the man who shoots straight and won't steer you wrong,
Johnny Appleseed himself,
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast. Thanks for joining us. However, I got a little bit of bad news, guys. This is going to be the last episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast and me hosting it. It's come to a shock as me. It's been a little bit of a hard thing to adjust to, but this is going to be the last one, and I'm sorry to bring it to you so abruptly. I'm just kidding, April Fools. That's a very terrible attempt at a bad joke. I'm not giving this up yet. Oh my goodness. Welcome back, guys. I hope the spring weather is treating you a little bit better, and it's got me thinking about a lot of different things, outside stuff. I'm still doing some outside stuff or inside stuff around my house, but man, the warmer weather's got me thinking some outside stuff, and I'm looking forward to getting out and doing that. I'm looking forward to get out and chasing turkeys. Getting ready for the upcoming season, and that's what we're talking about this week. But before I do talk about this episode, I wanted to share a little story with you guys. I had an awesome experience this past weekend. Our church hosts a sportsman's banquet annually. It's called the Beast Feast. And this year, they took the time to incorporate some of the people in our church as the speakers, and they did a hunter's round table. And, you know, they did like a panel series and interviewed a bunch of very experienced hunters from our church and got to share some things in the world of deer hunting and predator hunting and turkey hunting. And a great time of fellowship, great meal was spent, a lot of prizes given out. And then our pastor came up and spoke a little bit and thanked everybody from coming. But I tell you what, the coolest part of that whole experience was him talking about some of his hunting experiences. You know, he wrote a hunting story in our handout for the Beast Feast this year. And it was talking about some of the trophies that he's taken over the years. But it wasn't trophies the way you would normally think from the things that I've fixated on in my life of, you know, getting some nice deer hung on the wall and stuff like that. No, he's had some experiences like that, but the trophies that he brought home were things that included his kids, his three sons. Now his three sons are grown up, and now they've got kids of their own. And he shared some of those really, really cool experiences that he's had and how much of a praising God type moment it was. And then at the end of the night, he got up there and he spoke to everybody and thanked them for coming. And he told a story that I want to share with you guys. And I'm kind of stealing our pastor's thunder in this story here, but I think it's such a valuable thing that I wanted to share it with you. And he said, you know, he said, when I was younger, I used to really get into archery. He used to shoot competition archery. And he got pretty good. You know, he was shooting competitively. He talked about his Oneida bow a little bit. But he said, you know, we all talk about being in scorebooks, and you know, he talked about the Book of Pope and Young and the Book of Boone and Crockett, and how, you know, trophies of certain size and caliber would enter that book. But he said what really is important is the Book of Life, and are we going to be in the Book of Life? And he said, I've often thought about the Book of Life from the perspective of my archery hunting and archery competition journey. You know, when you shoot indoor archery, you got to shoot 60 shots. He said, and those 60 shots, he said, you got to hit a spot the size of about a quarter in order to continue on. That's about the size of a 10, and X is a little bit smaller. He said, he goes, what if our way in order to get into heaven, he said, what if it was an archery competition? He said, but instead of it being the 20-yard indoor competition, he said, it was you went to a 1,000-yard rifle range and set up a target, and in order to make it into heaven, you had to shoot 60 arrows, and those 60 arrows all had to land within the inside of a 4-inch circle at 1,000 yards, and you had to hit every single time, and if you missed the mark one time, your ultimate demise was going to be you went to hell. And you think about it like that, you stand there and you put yourself into that situation. I don't think there's a person on the face of this earth that could do something that perfect. And yet, in the midst of that archery competition, there's talk and there's gathering about somebody who did. And there stands Jesus, who had a perfect score, who sunk every arrow into that. He lived the perfect and absolutely honest life. The only one that ever lived it. Now here I am. Let's just look at it from the perspective of this is a real competition. And I finish my score and I don't even make one single arrow in the center of that target at 1,000 yards. And the tears are rolling down my face. I know my demise. And Jesus comes up to me and he said, and asks what's wrong. And I show him my scorecard. And he said, have you heard? And I said, yes, I've heard. He said, do you believe that I shot a perfect score? And I said, yeah, I believe what everybody's told me, the story, that you've done it. And he reaches in his pocket and grabs a scorecard. And he hands it to me and he says, do you want to trade? And that's the coolest analogy I think I've ever heard of what it means to trust in the Lord. To say, look, I can't do this alone. I'm not perfect. But you know what? He is. And he paid the cost. And that's what we're celebrating this week in Holy Week leading up to Easter. We're celebrating the man who lived a perfect sinless life, who shot every arrow in the 4-inch circle at 1,000 yards with a bow. And then when he was done, instead of taking the trophy, he handed his card to you and I if we believed that he could do it, that he was the Son of God, and said, here, do you want to trade? You can have a place and I'll take the punishment. And the punishment he took was like no other in history. The punishment of being whipped, beaten, to the point of exhaustion. The story is incredible. And then when he finally did die, and the earth quaked, the ground moved, the veil was torn in the temple. And this ain't your mama's veil. This ain't your mama's veil of curtains that are hanging out the front window that are thin in fabric that your two-year-old could rip. No, this was a veil that was, I don't know how long it was. I mean, the windows and the veil for the opening in the temple was huge. And it wasn't thin material. It was something that you probably could have put over yourself and kept warm during our winters. It was a very thick, heavy, and it was torn in half from top to bottom. And whatever 15, 20 plus feet long that it was a powerful moment. It was the scriptures being fulfilled. It was the truth, the Lamb of God that died, and he died for you. He wants to give you his scorecard. Guys, I really encourage you, if you don't know Christ, if you don't know the story of the Son of God, the King of the world, you don't know who Jesus is, guys, come talk to me. And you know what? One of the things I suggest is if you're listening to this and it's compelled you and you want to read something, get a Bible and read the book of John and just learn who Jesus is. But I would really encourage you, I really hope, guys, that you have peace of mind in knowing that you have a place in the book of life, because it's the only book that matters. So that was my experience this past weekend. And you know what was also cool is I got to share that with my son. You know, my son, he's in kindergarten, kindergarten, six-year-old. And, you know, he's learned quite the way to defy his parents over and over and over again and be a little bit of a stinker and not listen to mom and I and really test our patience. And I had a pretty cool moment last night where, you know, he was being a little bit selfish. He was worried about himself and not worried about his brother. And I told him that he was being selfish. And I said, but Lucas, I said, you know, you're not the only person who's ever been selfish. I said, your dad's been selfish. I said, your mom's been selfish. Your brother. I said, you got a lot of people in your life who you love and are great people, but they've been selfish before. And I said, there's only one person that's ever lived a life that was unselfish. And he started to go, he asked me, he said, who? And I said, well, who do you think it is? And he started naming all the people he knows. And I said, you know who he is. And he goes, who is it? I said, it was Jesus. And the look on his face was kind of like, oh. You know, Lucas, my son, has heard stories, but he could see it in an application of, you know, we weren't living the life we were called to be. And I told him, I said, look, buddy, it's not just you. Your dad doesn't. I said, your mom doesn't. We're imperfect. I said, but this is why we celebrate Easter. And you want to talk about an awesome demeanor change in a six-year-old telling a story that he's heard before, but from a different perspective. You know, it looked like in his mind, he was convicted. Man, I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me. You know, I've done wrong in so many ways, catching my words, saying things I shouldn't say, doing things I shouldn't do, thinking things I shouldn't think. I'm thankful that there's peace and there's hope for me, that somebody took the burden. My ways won't get in. I'm too sinful. I do the wrong things that I want to do. You can't live a perfect life. Nobody can. All right, guys. I wanted to share that with you. Hope you have a great Easter this week. This week, I have Jake Stanish on the podcast. Jake is the owner, founder, creator of Long Branch Turkey Calls. And he's a Pennsylvania boy, and he's got excitement for turkeys that is, I don't think it's matched. I mean, I think it is matched, but it's probably not exceeded. You know, this boy talked a lot about his experiences in turkeys, and we have an all-around preparation mindset type conversation of What are the foundations and what are the fundamentals in his mind in this world of chaos that we have? And, you know, is he somebody that likes to run and gun? Is he sitting and patient, you know, sitting and being patient? You know, we talk about some calling situations. Well, we talk about a lot and kind of just get the ball rolling into turkey season. And I think this is an episode that you guys are going to hopefully flip the switch with, especially as we've got this nicer, warmer weather coming in, and I'm thinking about turkeys. So let's dive into this episode with Jake. Guys, check our sponsors out, Radix Hunting. Check out their Monarch Blind Series and their chairs. I'm going to be rocking those. I might be taking somebody out in the youth hunt, and I think it's going to be an awesome opportunity to break that blind out. Sets up quickly, and it's quiet. It's good quality material. Check out Radix Hunting and all they have to offer. Huntworth. Probably be rocking Durham pants, and a lot of time I take the Sheldon hoodie. It's got a built-in face mask. I've been rocking the Disruption camouflage, but they've got a couple others from Vertec and a few others that are pretty cool patterns. All the patterns work in this area. Check it out, and you can check out all the else they have to offer at huntworthgear.com. And then lastly, it'd be Little Mountain Outfitters, archery shop located in Richland, Pennsylvania. Quality stuff, quality people, quality experiences. And if you want to support a local bow shop, but you're nowhere close to Richland, Pennsylvania, go to littlemountainoutfitters.com. It's everything bow hunting and even more. Check out what they have to offer. And if you use the code Woodsman10, Woodsman10, you can save yourself 10% off on your next purchase. Thanks, guys. Have a great week. Have a happy Easter. And take some time to be still this week.
All right, for the bird brain people out there, this is the first one of the 2026 season, and that is Talking Turkey with Jake Stanish from Long Branch Turkey Calls, right?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Mitchell. I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. So for a turkey hunting nut like yourself, first of all, I guess before we dive into it, Jake, please introduce yourself and tell people who you are, a little bit about yourself and a little bit of background about you.
Absolutely. So my name's Jake Stanish. I live in a small town in north central Pennsylvania called St. Mary's. Grew up and born and raised here my whole life. I've been turkey hunting since I was 12. As most of you from Pennsylvania know, back then we had to wait till we were 12 to start hunting. So started to hunt with my dad when I was 12. And really when I was a lot younger, would go and walk with them just to experience the outdoors and spend time with them. And since I can remember, I was probably 5 or 6. I watched a turkey hunting video. Back then they were VHS tapes, later on TNN, but I just became infatuated with the wild turkey, hearing them gobble, hearing them call, and just the whole aspect of trying to call and having a conversation with the wild animal just really hooked me. And I was obsessed when I was even before old enough to carry a gun. And then when I was a few years older, my dad took me out on 2 turkey hunts towards the end of the season one year, and we had great encounters, great hunts, lots of action, had turkeys raid in almost into gun range, but they were just a little bit too far for him to get a shot. Had a bunch of hens and a couple strutters out there hung up at maybe 50 yards, but that really set the hook, and I never recovered from it. You know, I'm 38 now, and in that time frame, it's only gotten worse and worse and worse every year. But yeah, I'm a turkey nut. If I had to make a choice between turkeys or deer, for me, it wouldn't even be a decision. I'd pick turkeys every time.
You know, that's a special place to be. I've asked the question to a number of people who are turkey, you know, avid turkey hunters. And I know a lot of people that talk about how much they love turkey hunting, but when I press the question of if the spring turkey season, you know, if the stars didn't align, that, you know, the mating season and the fancy time to hunt was in the spring, if you align that up with the whitetail rut, how many of people would choose turkeys over whitetails? And it's amazing how many times I ask that question, one of two things happens. Either A, they don't answer the question, they circle around it, or B, they just admit, well, I would deer hunt. And that's where I'm at. I love turkey hunting. It's a great thing for me to do in the springtime, and I've learned a thing or two. I've been pretty successful, but I've often always chosen deer hunting over turkeys. So it's often interesting for me at what point in the calendar year do I actually start to get what I call bird brain? And that's where nothing else matters but chasing turkeys. And it's different for me every year. So is there ever a time where bird brain shuts off for a person like yourself?
Maybe a little bit during the fall. I do get into whitetail hunting quite a bit once Halloween comes around. And I've actually, well, just this past fall, I had opportunities to chase turkeys while going to scout for deer on a rainy Sunday afternoon. And I had longbeards on one side of the road and hens and poults on the other side. And I stopped, looked up in the binoculars, and just kept on driving. Just, I don't know. Fall hunting can be fun, but for me, the more I get into the spring, I feel like you're almost to a point cheating yourself of the whole experience. I don't want to sound too holy in this, but to me, I just feel like if I shoot a longbeard in the fall, a lot of times they're not going to come in strutting. While they do strut in the fall, I've seen it and experienced it, it's not as common.
Right.
They will gobble in the fall, same thing, not as common. So without all of that interaction, to me, it doesn't make sense for me to kill one just to say I killed one. So for that reason, I choose to deer hunt and hunt other things that time of the year. Don't have a problem with people doing it, certainly. I used to really enjoy that. And when my kids get old enough to hunt, happy to take them fall hunting. But for me, just don't really have that deep burning desire to shoot a longbeard in the fall, and primarily too with the hens and the poults. You know, just the turkeys are starting to come back a little bit in some of the areas that I hunt, and just don't want to mess anything up by taking another bird out of that mix, because Jake's have nearly a 50% mortality rate. So if you shoot your young of the year Jake's, you're really hurting your potential population in the future, and you're gobbling turkeys for the next spring.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. You know, I don't talk about it anymore because it's almost sacrilegious to, but fall hunting, most people never experience fall turkey hunting. And fall turkey hunting is really fun, but my idea of fall turkey hunting was back in the years when you used to be very good turkey numbers, that a small flock of turkeys is our big flocks now. You know, a big flock to me right now is somewhere in that, you know, maybe 16 to 25 birds in a lot of the places that I'm at. Like, that's a big flock nowadays. And I remember years ago as a kid, places seeing 30, 40, 50 turkeys in a flock. And man, there's something about going through the woods and busting a flock of turkeys up and having them yucksing and carrying on and kikiing and kiki running and clucking and the Jake's gobbling and carrying on. Like, that is one of the most vocal times that you will get to hear. You will hear turkey sounds if you bust a turkey flock up that you'll rarely hear during the spring. I mean, you can, but the vocalizations you hear, and that is extremely fun. But to what you just said, anymore, I have a really, really hard time shooting a hen, and just with the way we're at, I would much rather do everything in my power to keep the population on the uprise. And if one day we get to a point where turkeys are, in plethora again, I'll think about it. But the vocalization part of it, I think, is really, really fun in the fall.
Without a doubt, I think you hit the nail on the head there. And another thing that a lot of people don't think about from the fall is that's how you can really learn to become a better caller and truly add a lot of realism to your calling ability, because there's no better teacher than the wild turkey. You know, maybe you choose not to shoot the turkeys. You just want to go out and interact with them. I have some friends that do that. They'll spend a lot of time in the woods just carrying a video camera, carrying a DSLR, or just carrying an audio recorder to try and get turkey vocalization so they can go home and practice to either just work on becoming a more proficient caller, or maybe they want to get better for a contest. But either or, being out in the woods that time of the year is really where you learn to be a great caller, because some of those vocalizations you don't hear a lot in the spring. And it's tough to know what that true pleading feeling is in a kiki run of that lost poult trying to find his brothers and sisters or mother after being separated, unless you're in the woods and you hear it all the time.
Well, another thing I think that happens too, like, in order to know your species, you got to spend time with them. And that's why I think, like, from the deer hunting side of things, people who archery hunt more learn a lot about their game, because they have to get closer to them. They have closer interactions. They have less chances to kill, because, you know, with a firearm, as long as it's in with the visual vicinity, it's probably going to get shot at in a very short amount of time. And the same thing I think can happen with turkey hunting, right? I mean, what's the traditional way you go turkey hunting, right? You hear some crazy vocalizations off the roost. Maybe you're lucky you roost a bird the night before and you hear turkeys talking. You move in, you hear that roost talk, they fly down. Maybe you kill one, maybe you don't, or maybe you get a mid-morning tom that, you know, breaks off of hens or whatever, and you're able to call them in. But when you're running and gunning for turkey hunting, which I think is what a lot of people do, especially in the woods of Pennsylvania, you don't really have a lot of up-close interactions. You might get vocalization and talk back and forth with a bird that you don't see, but how often are you looking at turkeys in the woods of Pennsylvania and not killing them? It happens, but a lot of time they're coming into tight quarters and you're killing them and you don't get to hear those interactions and vocalizations. The fall, I do think, is a little bit different just because there's usually more of them and like the whole behavior system is different. And I think it's a good way to learn turkeys.
Absolutely. When you really hear a lot of vocalizations is if you spend time in the woods prior to spring gobbler season starting in Pennsylvania. I know as a kid, I'd go out as much as I physically could. Usually once March 1st rolled around, I was out every day from March 1st through the end of turkey season. So into the latter days of May and even into June some years, even if I already got my turkey and I was just going out, I had to be out. I had to see the sunrise and I had to see if I was going to hear something or experience something that I may not ever see again. You know, there's always some one-off things and really cool things out there that you'll experience if you spend enough time in the woods. And half the time, once turkey season gets on, anybody that hunts a lot knows this, you get exhausted, you get tired easily, and there's just something that's either in you or isn't in you to make you want to keep going. And for me, I truly love it. Mm-hmm. And I don't even care if I'm the person that has a gun or not. There's a lot of times I don't carry a gun. I hunt with some other people, take a video camera, just want to go and experience it. I mean, it's cliche, but Toxie Hayes' saying of God only gave us so many sunrises, I'm not going to miss one. That's how I feel about turkey hunting. If I can be out there, I'm truly going to be out there. And I'm lucky that my wife is a huge turkey hunter as well. We have two little girls, so our time isn't what it used to be, but her and I trade off mornings before work. One of us hunts almost every single day of the season. So it works out really, really well to still be able to spend a lot of time in the woods. But April is when you'll also hear a lot of vocalizations leading up to the season as well. A lot of hens on the roost anymore, good gobbling. So really you can learn something about the birds and improve your knowledge and figure things out going out and just listening. And I used to go out all the time and still do. Go out, pick a high spot in the woods and just sit there and listen. Maybe I'll hoot a little bit, crow call. I don't take any turkey calls with me before the season, but you know, using a locator call, trying to see if anything's going to gobble and just see what they do throughout the morning and figure out where they go. If there's hangouts, ridges, benches, bottoms, and try to figure out where they're going and just get a better idea of their daily habits prior to hunting season is definitely going to put you way ahead of the game. If you can at least know where the direction that they're going to go off the roost in the morning and then set up in front of them, your chances of having them come are a lot better.
So as you're going through that, you know, you're somebody that's diehard and has done it for a long time, and you've spent a lot of mornings in the turkey woods, whether it's before the season, during the season, or even after the season. And, you know, I've definitely done my fair share of turkey hunting, but I haven't spent that much time. And one of the questions I was thinking, when you think about the scouting you do, you know, usually everybody, the height is in that April time as far as the gobbling, and that's usually where peak excitement's at for guys. It's the closest point to the season. My experience has been that's been some of the best gobbling and turkey behavior, some wild, crazy interactions I've had during that time. Then you lead into season, and maybe some of the things you saw, you know, the second half of April kind of trickle into the beginning of May. And things can really shift as you go through the month of May in Pennsylvania. And my one question I was thinking about as you were going through is all those pieces of the puzzle you were talking about putting together, listening to turkeys, watching what they do throughout the morning, where they go, how they behave, how they interact and stuff. Do you think that as we go through the month of May, generally speaking, do turkey patterns drastically change during the month of May? Or are they doing a lot of the same things, but they're a little bit quieter than they were during the month of April?
I'll answer that in two parts. So turkeys can change depending on hunting pressure and predator pressure. So if you have a spot where there's a gobbler that's just out there and he's gobbling his brains out every morning, eventually somebody's going to hear him and they're going to come in and attempt to call him in. So whether he comes into the calling and he smells a rat and spooks, he's going to get wiser. And then the same thing happens if he does get all the way into gun range and somebody shoots at him and misses him or wounds him and he gets away. He's not going to forget that. He's not going to stop gobbling necessarily, but he's going to be a lot more wary the next time he hears a hen. And he's going to really take his time, and you're going to have to do a lot of crafty things in those situations to add extra realism into your calling and setup to make sure that he really thinks that that's the real deal before coming in. I've even seen turkeys that they're not going to leave the area completely. They might go into the next valley or something, but yeah, pressure can change turkeys. It can make them usually a lot more difficult to get them to close. They might come into that 75-yard bubble, as they call it, and then hang up and really want the hen to go to them. Like nature's intending, you're actually trying to reverse nature in the spring by getting the gobbler to come into the hunter. But yeah, pressure can change that. I've seen turkeys before that start off early in the year, they gobble hard, they gobble a lot, and then after a week or two of hunting, they start gobbling less. But that's also two-folded as well. And I'm sure you've had this happen, Mitchell. I know I have. You're working a turkey and he's really hot and he's gobbling hard. And let's say you had to cover a lot of ground to get to him to close the distance. Maybe you had to go and cross a creek and go up on another ridge. The longer it takes for you to get to him and get set up, oftentimes he'll call a hen in that's going to come in, walk and just yelping and walk in and grab him and walk off with him. So as the season goes on, those gobblers are going to get some hens as well until they start to lay eggs and sit on the nest. So that's another part of the equation I think a lot of people don't remember, is that these turkeys are looking for hens. It's breeding season. That's their primary goal this time of the year, other than staying alive, is breeding hens and finding hens and staying with them.
All right, everyone, it's that time of year where things are greening up and I'm starting to think about food plots. And if you're doing the same thing, look no farther than Vitalize Seed, specifically Nitro Boost Spring and Summer Planting. It's the food plot that has the ability to fix atmospheric nitrogen and add diversity to your food plot mix. It's highly browse tolerant and adds a ton of benefit, not just to the wildlife, but for your soil. 30% more diversity than any other food plot you're going to find, and it's engineered for the proper carbon to nitrogen ratio to naturally feed your soil biology and set you up for a fall food plot like no other. Diversity is king for your wildlife and for your soil. Look no farther and check out Vitalize Seed.
So if the gobbling decreases, it may not be solely because of hunting pressure. They're looking for hens every day. They have hens. The more hens they have, the quieter they're going to be. They don't have to gobble to attract them. They're right there.
Absolutely. So I'm going through the final processes of the planning phase of the job that I have. You know, I work in agriculture and I do a lot of planning for farmers and stuff. And we talk through a lot of stuff and, you know, times are tight. And we're talking about making a lot of cuts or allocations. We're really trying to fine tune and make sure we're doing the basics right. And we're not missing the mark on that, but we're not adding fluff. We're not adding extra filler stuff that comes to that. You know, we're not overspending. Take that same concept and think about it from turkeys. The hunting industry, everybody that is into it wants to do something in it, make money, advertise, get sales, you know, products, this, that, and the other thing. And I'm curious, when you think about turkey hunting, there's so many things that can go in a turkey vest and different products and stuff and everything else that we've got. And I'm wondering, what are the essentials in your mind when it comes to turkey hunting? I'm gonna take you down, and I don't even I even think of, like, if I was gonna, like, you could only take five things with you or something like that. I don't know if that's the right number, but what is the bare essentials in your mind in order to allow you to have a successful turkey season? And not just for a day. I'm talking a season of turkey hunting.
So obviously your ammo and your shotgun are going to be one, but that's not really in your vest. In my vest, I'll say, do you want like individual calls, like let's say separate a mouth call from a box call is one, or how are you counting those?
I think I would count it as, what is your minimalistic basic package approach to saying this is going to allow me to be successful with, like, what's the foundation and what's the filler in the world of turkey hunting in your mind?
So to me, I'm going to have a turkey vest with a comfortable seat, water, some type of food, whether it's protein bars or a sandwich, depends on how long I'll be out. Toilet paper for the obvious reason.
Good point.
Several different types of mouth calls. Obviously, I have a call company, so I like to take a bunch of calls with me. But as the season wears on, start leaving some of the fluff like you're talking about out of the vest. So some mouth calls. Usually take a good box call with me. Then a range finder. And I would say that's about as minimalistic as I get. I've talked about different times depending on how long of a walk I'm going on. I've even gone as far as just grabbing a mouth call pouch full of mouth calls, a bottle of water.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill at its lowest price ever and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first and only GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Based on advertised cash price for 30-day supply of medication only. Membership required. Fee not included, and billed separately. Weight Loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Turn a shotgun and going.
I've done the same thing, and I think there's a little bit more in depth to that conversation, because it's like there's a lot to it, like how far are you going, is it a private farm, how much time do you have to hunt and stuff. But I'm just thinking about it from the sense of, you know, new hunter or been doing it for a while, and you kind of, I feel like there's a point as a hunter when you're new and you're getting into it, right? Everything's exciting, you got to try everything, you're still learning a lot. Not that we're not all learning, but I feel like you get to a point with hunting where you have enough experience that you can make your own decisions of what's best for you, and you don't find yourself spending as much money or looking for the next best thing. You kind of take experience of what you have and you run with it. And that's where I come back from that foundational. And it's one of those things where you don't necessarily learn it overnight. It takes time. But if you were going to give that recommendation to somebody that's sub 10 years turkey hunting, how do you get them to not miss the boat on the basics?
To me, the biggest thing is yeah, there's a ton of different calls out there, a lot of good ones, and there's a lot of different tones you can get from one particular call. So I would really talk to a new hunter and really make sure that they're proficient in the calls that they have. I'd rather have somebody that would take less calls with them, but be more proficient in making multiple different sounds with each one so that you can cover the whole gamut of sounds. Maybe take, you know, a friction call with you, something that's louder that can reach out and cover more ground, especially on a windy day or if you're trying to cover ground mid-morning. A couple different varieties of mouth calls. You know, there's a ton of different good ones on the market. They range from calls that are more quiet to louder to raspier pitched, higher pitched, you know, all kinds of different variations, but become proficient with everything that you carry instead of always looking to buy something new. You know, really spend some time with what you have. And the biggest thing to me is you want to make sure that you're camouflaged, you know, whatever pattern that you like to wear. Biggest thing is sitting still and not sitting in the sunlight and not silhouetting yourself to a turkey. I like to wear mossy oak. I think it works well with where I hunt, but there's a lot of great choices out there. Another big thing to me is knowing your capabilities of your weapon, whether it's a shotgun or a bow, making sure that you're patterning your shotgun. Try different choke tubes, try different shells. Shells have come a long, long ways. You don't have to get into TSS, but it can really make one shotgun work for every season. If you have a 20 gauge or a 410, you're not as limited anymore with your range with those if you know your gun. But regardless of what weapon you take, you have to know your limits and make sure that you're proficient shooting at whatever distance you're going to attempt a shot at. You know, turkey hunting is a game of how close, not how far. So I always tell people, don't get impatient. A lot of times a turkey will finish. You just have to give them time to get curious enough to come in looking for you.
So as always with a diehard turkey hunter like yourself, I'm sure one of the things that I think draws us to the game is the communication. I mean, that's probably what drove you to the point of having your own call company and getting, and we can get into that too. You know, as a person with, let's keep that mindset of talking to people that are on the newer side or maybe not as experienced turkey hunting. When you think about everything that's out there, like when you want to sell turkey calls, you know, there's a lot of calls companies out there. I'm not going to mention names, but there's call companies out there that do a fantastic job of marketing. You know, they're professional callers. They're world-renowned callers, and they're using these calls. And some of the sounds that they can make are absolutely phenomenal. And you usually get the highlight reel in those advertisements. And a lot of the time you hear that aggressive, excited calling in those scenarios. And I think it gives a perception of that's how turkeys always talk. So you get into focusing on making some of the highlight reel type sounds, which are important and are well used. But talk to me, Jake, what's your approach when it comes to foundations within turkey sounds and turkey communication?
Especially when I'm hunting, I like to start off quiet and build into some of that more aggressive calling if the situation calls for it. But I'm more of the class of I'm going to give him just enough to keep him coming, but I want him to look for me and I want him to hunt me. It's what always has worked well for me. It's something that took me a long time to figure out. But I like to give a turkey just enough to keep him looking for me. The easiest way I can explain that is think back to when you were younger chasing girls and you didn't want to get too overly excited and too talking to him too much. You gave him just enough to keep things going. And that's how I usually describe it to a younger hunter or a less experienced hunter is you just have to take that individual bird's temperature and see what he likes. There's some turkeys where you can cluck and purr and rake the leaves and give him soft yelps and he comes right in. You know, maybe that's a turkey that's been played with a bunch. Maybe that's a gobbler that's used to having a lot of hens around him or an older bird. And then you'll find those birds out there that they want you to call to them or they get wary and they start to drift away and you have to literally pound on them from the time you strike them and cut and yelp and cut and yelp and make a lot of noise and call a lot and have them come right in and they gobble the whole way of the gun. You know, those are the ones everybody dreams of, but that's definitely not the norm, at least where I hunt. They're going to gobble, but they're not all going to come in and want a lot of loud, aggressive calling. So I'm one where I like to take their temperature, see what they like, give them a little bit, see what they do, and just kind of feel the situation out. That's something that can be difficult for people to figure out, I feel like. I know when I was younger, I struggled with it. But a lot of times, less is more. But you have to be able to read that bird and just see how they're reacting. If they're gobbling a lot and they're coming, they're moving closer to you, then keep doing what you're doing. But if they seem like they're taking their time and hanging up, try something different. You know, if you've been calling soft to a gobbler and he's coming and then all of a sudden throws the brakes on, maybe you need to give him a little bit more. Maybe you need to go silent. It's really tough to tell in a podcast exactly how to do it, but, you know, experience will give you clues and indications on what you need to do in that situation if a gobbler does hang up. Some turkeys, if you go quiet on for half an hour, they come right in. Other turkeys, if you go quiet on them, they turn around and you never hear from them again that morning, and you know you have to try something different the next time you hunt them. But experience is going to play into a lot of those situations and really just how you handle them.
Oh, I think the statement hindsight is 20/20 is as the loudest in all forms of hunting when it comes to turkey hunting. I mean, it's definitely one of those things that I feel I always end up saying shoulda, woulda, coulda in the world of turkey hunting and how I talk to them. You know, one of the things I've picked up on the last few years is how I talk to turkeys based off of knowing the cycle of hatches. And I don't know if I've heard people talk about this or not, but I'll give you an example. A couple years ago, there was an incredible hatch relative to what I had been seeing in years past. And there was an abundance of Jakes the 1 year. The following year, with the amount of two-year-olds that were present, I feel like a two-year-old is like the best turkey. Like they're not much smarter than, they're not much better off than a Jake, but man, they sure gobble and love to respond to calling and stuff. And like how I've communicated with turkeys is somewhat determined on what I think is in the generarian in the first place. Am I out left field with that thinking, or have you experienced something like that?
No, I've definitely experienced similar situations before, but for me, I take the turkey's temperature more than I change my calling based on that. At least the way that I hunt in the areas that I hunt, I like to try and just react to that individual bird that I'm having the conversation with. But I've definitely seen situations like you're describing. I know 1 year it stands out in my mind particularly. It was a long time ago. I know in one spot we called in a dozen Jakes in one bunch. Talk about a lot of fun. Coming in, they're bumping into each other, gobbling, and they had me confused. They had real good, strong gobbles. They were early hatched the year before when they were born, so they were born, I would guess, sometime in April. So their beards were a little bit longer, but we were thinking the last one coming through was going to be the long beard, and it was just a strutting Jake. But yeah, that can always be a lot of fun. You just never know what you're going to encounter out there. And you know, the last couple seasons, at least around here, it seems like the turkeys may not have had as good of a hatch. So you notice more gobblers that are older. So you may hear less gobbling in those areas that didn't have as good of a hatch. So I guess on the other hand, yeah. And then in those situations where there's less of them and the turkeys are older, you're normally going to call a little bit less just because you don't hear as much of the vocalizing out there as you would if there were more two-year-olds around.
One of the things that I've felt like has happened, at least I've experienced it from my own dumb mistakes, but I've seen and heard other people talking about and doing, is like, how aggressive do you get? Not necessarily just from the calling, but how aggressive do you get from the mobility side of things? Because I feel like when a turkey starts talking and gobbling, or maybe worse, if it's not talking and gobbling, it just makes people want to get up and walk around and move around and try to find a locating bird. And I do it, and there's nothing wrong with doing it, but sometimes I find I find we just bumble around looking for a gobbling turkey, and I feel like we're shooting ourselves more in the foot than anything, because we're not really using woodsmanship. We're not really hunting our way. We might be walking roads, walking trails and stuff, but not maybe giving consideration to the noise we distribute when we're walking, the visual acuity a turkey might have from the places we're going. I mean, how do you manage, or how do you approach your aggressive style versus being patient, not from the calling side of things, but from the hunting sort of things? Like, how do you hunt the turkey without the communication piece?
I'm aggressive when it comes to moving, just because I'm impatient. I absolutely hate deer hunting a turkey. If that's what it takes and there's no other game in town, sure, I'll do it. But man, I like to cover ground, and I like to find a turkey that wants to do it. You know, to your point earlier, there's a turkey out there somewhere, and it's his day to come in and his day to die. You just have to find him. So in my mind, I'm lucky to have a lot of spots. So I like to cover ground and try to find a turkey that's ready to go. But I've heard and I've read, and I know that may not always be the most successful tactic. It just might be the one that a lot of people use because they like to cover ground and they don't like to sit still. I have several friends that if they set up on a turkey in the roost and they have a good indicator that he has hens, they won't move for sometimes 2 or 3 hours and really try to wait that gobbler out. I wish I had the patience to do that. I'm going to make a really conceited effort to try to do that this spring, but that's not something I've been super successful with in the past, just because I'm not patient.
I think persistence is what kills turkeys most of the time. Like, I'm somebody who, you know, probably falls in line with how you're describing your friends of sitting and waiting a turkey out, to the point where I've probably missed opportunities on killing turkeys because I didn't move. And vice versa, I think, you know, somebody like yourself that takes the approach of wanting to move, you may miss the opportunity to kill turkeys if you would just sit and be patient a little bit more. I don't believe that one is better than the other. I think both are equal, because there's all sorts of different types of turkey hunters and they continually fill their tags. So is it the style that is most effective? In my opinion, no. I think it's just being persistent and not quitting. Because what's not going to consistently kill turkeys is hanging it up by 8 o'clock and saying, oh, the fun's over, that, you know, they're shut down for the day, which is what I think a lot of people talk, especially when my favorite is the first week of season. Well, it's all over. The junior hunt ruined the turkeys. It's too late. They're done breeding. They're done gobbling. Like, I just love hearing those, because I don't say anything. I just kind of chuckle to myself.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think the biggest thing out there is just you have to go as much as you can, as often as you can, for as long as you can, whether it's every weekend, whether it's a couple hours in the morning before work, or maybe you're lucky like some of us and you can go for an hour every day before work and then hunt weekends and take a couple vacation days. But the more time you spend in the woods, the odds are getting better every time. That turkey has to win every day to stay alive. We only have to win once. I've had seasons where I hunted every day to some capacity, and it took me until the last week or even the last day to finally kill a gobbler or get an opportunity on one. And a lot of times it's because he loses his hens later on in the season, and then you get your opportunity because you're the first hen he hears after all of his hens went to go sit on the nest. So a lot of people don't put enough faith, in my opinion, into hunting later in the season, and I absolutely love hunting the late season. I mean, it can be uncomfortable. It gets hot, bugs, snakes, all those types of things. But a lot of times you get a turkey going later in the season or later in the morning, and there's a pretty good chance he's coming your way. And a lot of times your birds later in the season that come in, they've got a nice set of spurs on them.
Yeah, I feel like killing bigger turkeys has been something I've experienced later in the season. I mean, this one that's over my shoulder here was the biggest turkey I ever killed. I think it was like a 23-pound bird. It had a 12-inch beard. It had an inch and a half spurs. Like, it was a freak of a turkey that I didn't even know existed in the woods. I didn't even know he was there. I just called this turkey in and, you know, toward the end of the season, shot him and was dumbfounded. I was like, what the heck is this you know, Godzilla creature. yeah, they're fun. They're fun critters. They annoy the daylights out of me. And, you know, you were talking about hunting every day and getting a little bit of time in. I can echo that. My schedule, I have a bunch of places I can go, but I have little time. So I try as diligently as possible to get my butt out of bed, go drive wherever I'm going for work that day, but within the vicinity of that work location, I'm going to try to go hunt for an hour, hour and a half, and then I got to go to work. Now, my work schedule, I'm not going to the same job every day. I'm going all over these different places. So I might hunt Farm A on Monday, Farm B Tuesday, Farm C Wednesday. I might not cycle back or have a chance to cycle back to Farm A until the end of the week, maybe not even until the following week. So my question to you is, like, there's two sides to that, right? The part of me thinks I spread my hunting pressure out, but there's another part of me that thinks that maybe I'm not learning the intel, and there's too much gap for me to learn a bird. Like, if I worked a bird Monday but didn't kill him, and I have to wait a week until I can hunt him again, something could have changed by then. And I have to balance and how to manage my hunt. So what as I'm telling you about that, like, what's your approach? Like, do you try to stay persistent if you find a bird? Do you like to rest things? Like, how do you take the temperature in that way?
I'll give you an overview and I'll go into it then. It just depends. So for me, I'm lucky to where we have a lot of area that we can hunt. So we can hunt hundreds of thousands of acres around here. And I'm lucky to have also a father and an uncle that I hunt with often who are retired did also spend a lot of time in the woods, and we share Onyx pins all the time if one of us hears a hot gobbler or hears any turkey. You'd laugh if you saw what my Onyx looked like. It looks like a pin cushion, and with all of the intel that we have. So I'll usually give a turkey, I don't know, 3 days, three hunts, give or take. And if I'm still making headway, normally you like to get in there and hopefully get them the first time you're on them. But if not, learn something each time to put yourself in a little bit better situation. If you start seeing a pattern, maybe he flies down and he goes out towards the point of the ridge. Well, then the next morning, I'm going to get there earlier and try to get close to where he flew down or where he landed. If that doesn't work, maybe you have to get a little bit closer from there. And once I start actually getting in and trying to hunt a turkey like that is when I'll try to roost them. I don't do it often. But if it's a turkey that you know you're close to and you can get them to gobble at night on the limb, which I don't know for you, Mitchell, if it happens much, but the turkeys around here, they seem to have really gotten quiet in the evenings.
As you're talking about that, the amount of birds that I have heard gobble at night, man, they are few and far between. And I often wonder, is that have anything to do with the way I'm doing it? Is it have to do with pressure or historical hunting pressure? Or is it geography based? I mean, you have to figure, like, I've watched videos and talked with some pretty doggone good turkey hunters that are from the South. And I mean, from everything I've ever heard, the Southeast seems to have some of the most legacy-based hunting pressure for turkeys out of anywhere. I mean, not that Pennsylvania doesn't have a legacy of turkey hunting. We do. But I see and hear people making, you know, roosting birds all the time and putting, you know, quote-unquote, putting birds to bed or having an idea where one is roosted. I have tried so many times listening from ridges, you know, doing locator calls. I just don't have that much luck with it.
I think it's another thing of persistence. I know people around here that'll roost one every night, but I don't know how far they drive between point A and point B until they do it. Mm. You know, they might put 100 miles on trying to do it. You know, you don't know those parts of the story. But I think the biggest thing is going into these areas where you know the turkeys are. And there's a lot of times where I'll go in there at night and I'll back up maybe 100 yards from where I feel they're going to roost. And I just listen for the hens to make some noise, or maybe you'll hear them scratching in the leaves and feeding before they fly up. So you may not hear that gobble, but there's still clues out there that give you critical intel to where that turkey is and where you need to set up. And another thing I've noticed too, and we had this happen a couple of years ago, hunted a spot for the first time that year, knew there's normally turkeys out on the point of this hill and heard a couple. So we got in close, set up, and we walked through turkey scratching before we sat down. And I've noticed a few times, if you set up and scratching, there's normally a good chance they're going to come back through there in the morning if you're set up either in it or close to it, because they went through that area right before dark, not a lot of times if it's fresh, so they feel safe coming back to that area.
That's a great point. And, you know, we were talking about this earlier in the podcast, and I think I want to circle back to it. You know, everybody gets hung up on calling. Don't get me wrong. I love calling. I've improved my calling game. I've learned more about turkey vocalizations. I've learned how to make them and, you know, when to I feel is best to use them. And it's increased my success in talking to turkeys. But I still think the statement I heard years ago from somebody was, take a good fall turkey hunter and he's a deadly spring turkey hunter. And I believe that just from the side of the woodsmanship, the reading sign, the understanding some of their feeding patterns and how they behave. And if you can read the sign and figure that out, like the calling aspect in the spring is almost like an icing to the cake in many senses, because you know where birds are and how they're behaving. Now you just need to find a turkey that's in the right position. But I think that puts you in the right position way more often.
Yeah, it definitely can. You know, being in the right spot is critical. You can't call a turkey into a place that he doesn't want to be called into a lot of times. Might be able to coax him into some right. of those spots if he's in the right mood. But the majority of the time, if you set up in an area he wants to be in, you're way ahead of the game.
Certainly. So, onto the topic of calling, you know, we weren't planning on, you know, making actually turkey calls, so to speak, but I wanted to talk a little bit about your call company. So, like, first of all, I know how you got into this. It's because you're a turkey hunting fanatic and you wanted a little bit more and you were interested in it. But, you know, talk to me about maybe some of the other motives just behind the pure enjoyment of turkey hunting. Like, what fascinated you about call specifically? Like, why not go into the shotgun reloading? Why not other aspects of gear? Why calls?
To me, it was something I wanted to do since the time I was about 5 years old, and I started to see that people could make a living and could make some money and put out good products from the time I was, you know, a little kid, you know, growing up in Pennsylvania. Quaker Boy isn't far up the road, so seeing Dick Kirby, that was really just enlightening, seeing, oh, hey, people can make a living out of getting to turkey hunt. Yeah, you still run your business and there's a lot of other parts to that, but I was just always infatuated with sounding more like the real thing. So then back in around 2010, I got into calling contests, did that for a couple of years. And when you get into the calling contest, you usually start out in the amateur, and then after you win an amateur contest, you have to enter what they call the open, or some people call the professional division, where you're calling against your top talent, you know, your guys and gals that are calling in Nashville every year. And quickly realized I was in over my head, so I took a break from that and knew I needed to change my sounds and just work on mechanics and just be a better caller. That's one thing a lot of people realize when they get into contest calling is, you're just another good turkey caller out there. There's good callers and there's great callers. So took that time and ordered a hand jig from a gentleman by the name of Thad Bright. He makes turkey call presses to make mouth calls. And I started tweaking things and trying to build my own calls. And I just wasn't happy with the sounds I was getting, even with what I was making. So I kind of tabled it for a couple years and still hunted, didn't compete anymore, but just wanted to figure it out. So then I ended up buying a press off of Thad, and I just got it in my head. I'm figuring this out if it's the last thing I do. So started tweaking more, playing more, built a ton of calls that I didn't like that went right in the garbage can, and eventually had my aha moment and built a call, put it in my mouth, and I was like, that's what it was. I finally figured this out. So started building some calls and giving them to buddies to try, ask them, you know, what do you think of this? Let's change a stretch on this. Let's cut a bat wing instead of a split V and just tweaking different parts of the process. And then a lot of them kept saying, I like these better than what's on the market. You should really think about starting a company. So I talked to my wife about it a little bit, who I mentioned is an avid turkey hunter. And I was going back and forth with it. And she told me one night, she said, either start this company or stop talking about it. One of the two. But you got to make your mind up. So I said, well, it looks like we're starting a company. So went and secured the name, started the business, and kind of been here ever since. But just really started because I wanted to make a call that was easier to use than what was available on the market. You know, like your comment earlier, a lot of the companies, they build calls for contest callers. You know, and what I mean by that is there's a lot of great callers out there, a lot of companies that make a lot of good products, but some of them, it seems like they focus too much on the guys and gals that like the calls that are made out of thicker materials and they're stretched tighter because they can get prettier, fancier yelps and cuts and different sounds out of them than some of the ones that are made for the average hunter. And I just saw that was a gap in the market. So I was like, well, let's see what happens. Let's see what the response is and build some calls and just kind of see where it goes. And it's been really rewarding. Sitting here building mouth calls, I just get myself in the frame of mind of, you know, I'm building something that somebody else is going to make a memory with. And, you know, building calls can get monotonous at times. I'm one of the few people I think out there that enjoy building mouth calls. With it being a monotonous task, you know, that's where my mind always goes, is I'm building something that somebody else is going to make a memory with. I wonder what it's going to be. Is it going to be, you know, a parent taking their kids out or someone just going out and hunting by themselves? I just had a buddy of mine take some of our calls to Hawaii last week, and they killed a couple gobblers down there with them. So you really just never know how far your product is going to reach. And I love hearing the success stories of other people making a memory with something that I made. It's just, to me, it's really satisfying, just really cool.
It is amazing where turkey calls have gone from start to finish. I mean, I look back at some of the old DVDs. Somebody got me one of the Primo's turkey hunting DVDs, and they have, I think it was at 30 years, they did like a highlights video from the Truth one all the way through to wherever they were 30 years later in videos, and kind of see those old hunts from the mid to late 80s and go through now. And you listen to the calls and look at the calls they were using, the mouth calls specifically. Man, they were rough. They didn't sound as good. Some of the calls and the sounds that they made were, man, if I'd hear that now, I'd think, what in the world is that? But, you know, they killed turkeys and stuff, and I often struggle with that because I listen, there's people that are way better at turkey calling than me, and I often wondered, from your perspective, what is the difference between a good turkey caller and a great turkey caller?
There's a lot of people that can make good sounds, but to me, the biggest thing is how it's presented. One way to easily explain what I mean there is if you go on YouTube, the NWTF has the Grand National Calling Championships, which are the Super Bowl of turkey hunting. They're held in Nashville, Tennessee at the convention every year. If you listen to the senior open finals and listen to the scenarios, they'll give the callers a scenario of, for example, a hen waking up on a limb, flying down and feeding in a pasture. Just listening to how those guys can tie those sounds together, to me, that's what makes a great turkey caller, is the sound is there, but the cadence and the pauses and how it flows together. Does it sound like a flock of turkeys or a single bird doing what they're describing? To me, is what really makes a great turkey caller. You have to add that realism into it.
That makes good sense. So what's some of the biggest things that you think take a hunting scenario for novice turkey hunters and adds the most realism? Is there any one thing or any couple things that stand out to you to taking your turkey calling into the side of more realism for successful turkey hunting?
To me, the biggest part of realism is you have to sound like the animal, and you can't be, how can I word this? You really need to act like and sound like the turkeys in the area that you're hunting. like you talked about before, some of the turkeys in the southeastern part of the country are known for not being as vocal. So if you're hunting down south, an example, that would be not making a ton of aggressive calling unless you hear some of the turkeys in that area that are calling like that. You want to fit in. You want to sound like the rest of the birds out there. You know, maybe there's a situation where you need to challenge them, but for me, I like to make sure that like that you listen to turkeys all the time, right? Because that's really what's going to help add that little bit of realism in there is, you know, maybe it's those little those whits and whines and under the breath type yelps that turkeys do sometimes when they're feeding and they're real close to you that could give that gobbler that little bit of reassurance that, hey, there's a real hen or there's a flock of hens just over the hill. I need to peek over and I'll be able to see them. Or maybe it's being able to cut and yelp and transition nicely from one to the other one and have good rhythm, you know, making sure that when you're yelping, it's quote unquote, not too fast, or your cutting isn't run together. Make sure that you're not overcalling another turkey, because if you listen to turkeys, a lot of times you'll notice they don't call over one another. Occasionally they do, but for the most part, those turkeys, when they call back and forth, it's like when we have a conversation, you don't interrupt the other person. You listen after you get done calling. So as you're calling, an easy way to build it in cadence and rhythm is to just naturally pause and listen for a response.
Yeah, right. Well, Jake, I have to admit, I am not in bird mode yet. But a conversation like this is enough to get me to start thinking about it. So as we start getting warmer temperatures and, man, the birds start chirping and I can get some of this winter work crap and get out and get into some spring work stuff, it's going to start to make me feel like it. So I appreciate this conversation. This was really good. Before I let you go, can you do me a favor and can you just plug your company that you got and where can people find you and you know, learn more about the calls that you have to offer and see what you're all about.
Absolutely. So our website, longbranchgamecalls.com, have all of our calls there. And there's some how-to articles in the blog section as well. A couple hunting stories, if that interests you. On all social media channels, we have Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, any of those. And then we'll be at the Pennsylvania Central Outdoor Show, if anybody is in Clearfield, Pennsylvania this coming weekend. Be there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, March 20th through the 22nd. And then for all of your listeners out there, if you're wanting to try some of our calls, we have a discount code for you guys. It'll be 15% off. It'll be all caps lock and all one phrase, PA Woodsman. So PAWOODSMAN. And that's good for 15% off.
Sweet. Well, guys, take advantage of that for sure, because it's right around the corner. Get some calls. And, man, I'm hoping that this year, this is the third time I've ever had the opportunity, but the first time I messed it up. I'm hoping that I can seal the triple trophy. I got two of the three, and I got one more to go. So I am starting to get a little bit excited. So this is the fuel I needed. So I appreciate it, Jake.
Absolutely. It was a great conversation. I hope you're able to get that triple trophy. It's a heck of an achievement if you're able to do it.
Thank you.